This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A compassionate plea for sympathy after Dallas.
Your work and the work of police officers across the country is like no other.
And here's a superficial grab at a soundbite after Dallas.
It's a war on cops, and the Obama administration is the Neville Chamberlain of this war.
That's William Johnson, executive director of the National Association of Police Organizations. He was one of many voices last week fanning flames of anger after the murder of those five police officers in Dallas. President Obama, in his speech yesterday to honor the fallen officers of the Dallas PD, tried to quiet those voices of anger and more widely to acknowledge both the special role and challenges faced by police departments all over America today.
For the moment you put on that uniform, you have answered a call that at any moment, even in the briefest interaction, may put your life in harm's way.
The idea of a war on cops may be convenient for cable TV graphics, but there's no evidence of such a war if you look at the numbers. The number of police officers who have been intentionally killed on the job has fallen from 101 per year during the Reagan years to 90 annually under George H.W. Bush, 81 under Clinton, 72 per year under George W. Bush, and down to 62 annually under President Obama, a figure that doesn't change even when accounting for the Dallas ambush. Chuck Wexler, the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, says the disconnect means we can at least acknowledge that we're doing better than we often think we are regarding police violence and violence against police.
In the 60s and the 70s, you did have a lot of police officers that were killed, more so than today, and ambushed, deliberately killed. You had Black Panther movement and the fight back and forth between the police from New York to Oakland. So you did have police that were killed and assassinated. In the 1970s, you might have 10, 20 police officers in New York City who were killed. So, you know, it was a difficult time then, much like it is now. But overall, the numbers have come down. But I don't know if we can attribute that to anything more than the fact that you do have officers wearing body armor and you do have officers are being told to wear seatbelts. Those two things, we got labor and management together to agree on the mandatory wearing of seatbelts and body armor. So, you know, it's sometimes difficult to compare because those two factors can really cut down on officers dying.
Do officers coming into the departments and coming into the police academy have a sense that there is a war on cops taking place in America, that they've heard that rhetoric?
I don't believe there's a war on cops at all. I think the good news, quite frankly, is, you know, most communities, there's a good relationship with the cops. You know, I think the whole country, when they saw what happened in Dallas, was just stunned. It was just stunned. And so I don't think the rhetoric, the politicians and so forth, they're going to use this sad occasion for their own purposes. But at the end of the day, the good news is that overall crime is down compared to 20 years ago. When the people look at a situation like Dallas and they look at the Dallas Police Department and all the progress they make, and then they see these five officers who are walking with demonstrators to protect their First Amendment rights, joking around with the demonstrators, taking pictures, tweeting with each other, and then they get murdered. I think the public, really the general public, basically is sympathetic. It doesn't mean that there's not a lot of room to change and to find more strategies to de-escalate some of these situations that don't involve firearms. I think that there's an opportunity. You know, the president's message yesterday in Dallas was really, I thought, pretty powerful. And we really need to find ways to continue to build upon what we've already done. But there was a lot to learn from last week.
The president certainly made the point that we need to take action, that this is not a time for complacency. But he also wanted to say that don't forget we've been doing better on a number of fronts. Do you think there's a disconnect between our perception of how tense things are on the street, how much danger there is, how much police violence there is, and the actual numbers of incidents?
Oh, I think that's that is correct. generally speaking, if you go from community to community, people will say, well, we like our police. But what happens, and what's happened the past couple of years, is I don't think you can discount the impact of some of these very difficult videos. When the American people see a side of life that is very difficult to watch, we have never had that. You'd have to go back 20 years to the Rodney King incident to see that image, which had that searing image played over and over again. Now, today, it's not unusual to see one kind of video or another that portrays the police in a difficult position. I think the troubling part from a policing standpoint is you're not seeing what led up to that situation. Not that that would necessarily change what you see, but it might help you put it in context. I think there's two things happening. I think on the national level, you know, the American people are seeing a side of policing that they had not seen and are asking questions. And on the other hand, from the day-to-day perspective of local police departments and their communities, you know, they engage pretty well. So I think you have both of those things happening simultaneously. But there's from our standpoint, from a policing standpoint, we look at these kind of situations, whether it be officer-involved shootings or whether it be attacks, ambushes on police, and we say, how can we reduce that overall fatalities on both sides? What can we do to bring down the tension level, to introduce practices that will make the police more effective? And then there's also a responsibility on the part of the community to engage with the police, to work with them, to be part of community policing programs. So I think there's some responsibility that's necessary on both sides.
Chuck Wexler is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now the story of a turnaround on the street from someone who pleads for empathy on all sides, but barely survived what it took to get here to tell his story. Dee Watkins would say he does come from a war zone, the streets of East Baltimore, where violence and tragedy were the cross streets to a wide avenue of hopelessness. He saw his brother die. He's a former drug dealer himself, and at age 14, he wrote a paper in history class called The 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered. But after attending college and getting a master's degree in education from Johns Hopkins University and an MFA in creative writing from the University of Baltimore, his latest book was published last year, and it's called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. Dee Watkins is now a teacher, calling for the same kind of empathy on all sides that President Obama spoke about in Dallas this week. Through the Baltimore Writers Project, Dee Watkins has found a voice and the way to show others how to find their own voices of hope and respect.
It's a transformative moment. It's a very, very, very dark time in our country. And what I would like to see is a lot of writers take the opportunity to express themselves while considering people who they would, you know, call the other side. I think it's a time for unity, but I think we're not going to really get there until we really flesh these feelings out.
What is an example of something that needs to be fleshed out as opposed to stating positions, which we've heard before? You know, everyone's against guns, everyone's against racism, but when it gets down to actual what I'm going to do, that's a different story.
The first thing I wanted to do was get out there and let all police officers know that I don't want to see any of you ever be hurt or die. That's a horrible thing. I employ people, and these people, they pay taxes, and we want to be protected, and we want to be taken care of, and we want these rights. So we respect you and what you do, and we don't want to see you go through pain. But at the same time, we want you guys to feel the same way about us. Police officers, especially where I'm from, treat me like I'm an out-of-control crazy person, like I'm not a writer, like I'm not a professor, like I'm not a person that tries his best to engage young people and bring about positive change.
So let's say I'm standing in front of you and I'm saying, hey, Black Lives Matter, without saying Asian Lives Matter and all the other lives matter, or President Obama is endorsing a war against cops. He's favoring Black Lives Matter, and that means he's endorsing a war on cops. How do you reach behind those words that on the first glance are very upsetting and just try to get that empathy thing that you're talking about.
So, you know, for me, I think that the women who started this movement, they wanted to raise awareness and put fiery energy behind some of the murders that have been going viral in our country. I don't think it was a disrespect to white people. I don't think it's a disrespect to Asians. I don't think it's a disrespect to anyone. It's one movement. It's like, you know, I'm not going to walk into a rally where someone is trying to raise awareness on HIV AIDS and start yelling out cancer matters, you know? You can, there's so many different fights that need to be fought in this country, and this is just one.
You know, if we were actually in the same community together and this was a natural integration of American life, what do you imagine we would talk about other than these difficult conversations?
You know, our country has just so many things that could make America a better place, but yet we can't get past something simple as race. And I go places and I interact with all types of people. And, you know, our conversations, they already extend beyond race. Like, you know, we talk about these issues when it becomes like hot topics in the media. But, any you know, how do we, you know, how can we be more efficient with energy, technology? How can we educate more? What is it life like in different parts of the country? Like all of these different things that can help us become better people.
What did your older brother teach you?
How to run towards problems. You know, he always used to, like, have a real big issue with people that just, like, okay, I'll take care of this later. I'll take care of that later. You know, his thing was always to run towards it. Like, yo, this is the worst thing that can happen to me. Okay, cool. Let me just dive right into it.
Your brother was brave?
Yeah, I think he was. I think he was intelligent, and I think he was brave. I don't think he had the skill set to push that bravery as far as it could have went. Because him, like a lot of people from my neighborhood and my family, they just didn't travel enough. You know, they just didn't. I feel like so many people, their lives would be different if they just got outside of the neighborhood. Like my whole world was in my neighborhood. So, you know, it was a point in my own life where if you didn't live on a certain block or a certain street, I wasn't even really willing to open up and talk to you. And that's crazy. This is why, like, a dude on the street can just blow somebody else's head off. It's like, we can't communicate. We can't communicate because we're not being exposed to anything. So it just stuck.
So politically, before we go, what does leadership mean at the national level or the city level or at a level that's going to affect groups that don't see each other on the street corner but maybe do have a chance to come together?
I think we move past the point of one person bringing everybody together. You know, I think as educators, as parents, as people who do community work, we just have to do our job at exposing other people to different realities. I don't know what it's like to be an Asian trying to assimilate to American culture at a big university. I don't know these things, but I think if we share this place together, I need to acknowledge those experiences. I need to listen to those people when they tell those stories, just like I want them to listen to mine. And I think if we do that, social relations will enhance. I don't think political leadership is going to be the key for this generation. I think it's about us just acknowledging each other and sharing our stories, you know, simple stuff.
D. Watkins, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. Have a blessed one.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And can you think of something that quickly takes over the mind of anyone who comes in contact with it?
That's interesting. I kind of rather just play on my couch, but I guess I have to move around for it.
It quickly controls the mind and the body.
You're playing right now? How long have you been playing?
Today, probably about 6 hours. I'm on lunch break right now, but I've been walking around for most of the afternoon.
The responsible authorities are clearly playing catch up with this rapidly spreading got me.
I think we need to consider closing the schools down.
And who stays home with the kids? When will we know what this is? What causes it? What cures it? Things that keep people calm.
So are you guys on your lunch break?
Yeah, lunch break.
And were you guys like, let's go hang out and then play Pokemon Go?
Yes. More like, let's go play Pokemon Go.
Right? Yeah.
Hoje uma coisa pouco diferente, a gente tá aqui pra jogar Pokémon Go, Pokémon Go, Pokémon Go, Pokémon Go.
Yes. More like, let's go play Pokémon Go.
Yeah.
Nice.
What causes it? What cures it? Things that keep people calm.
Aqui, achei. É Zubat? É Zubat?
You're playing right now? How long have you been playing?
Today, probably about 6 hours.
Oh, actually, whoa, a Diglett popped up.
And we need to know how big the population of people susceptible to the virus might be. So far, that appears to be everyone with hands, a mouth, and a nose.
And one more thing. Everybody with a smartphone.
Were you guys into Pokemon when you were kids, too?
Absolutely. Yes.
It was my entire childhood.
Yep, me too.
Agora vai, agora vai. E matei o primeiro Pokémon dele. O segundo é forte pra caramba.
Pokémon Go is not a disease or a virus. It is a contagion that has overwhelmed app stores on Google and iTunes. It's an alternate reality game that merges the world around you with a Pokemon reality. And for people into Pokemon, this is reality.
I need to get more exercise, and this is helping a little bit at least. I actually went out with a group of friends over the weekend and walked around up in the Bronx to check out, see what we could find around us.
It gets people to move around.
It's much more
I've
active.
I've gone on like 3 walks with my roommate, and I've lived with her for like 2 years, and we've never gone on a walk together.
So how excited were you when you heard about this?
Oh my gosh, so excited. I signed up to be a beta tester, actually.
Did you?
But I didn't get it.
Players collect Pokemon creatures or stop at landmarks called Pokestops to pick up new gear. It's vaguely competitive, but mostly it just passes the time.
I've actually made a couple of friends in my town that I didn't even know were like Pokemon people, would have never met them. Big adult guys just playing, just challenging kids at gyms. Kids coming up to my building because my building is actually a Pokestop and being like, hi, how are you? She just caught a Pokemon.
Yeah.
This is kind of it. Like we get people coming up, you get to talk to people. It's great.
Oh, here's one. A wild Doduo. See, I didn't play when I was little, so I don't actually know any of the names, but that doesn't make this any less fun for me. Yeah, since now I'm like blocking the busy sidewalk.
Oh, actually, whoa, a Diglett popped up.
This one's tricky, it's leaping out of the way.
Just walking up this trail here.
Okay, got it. Yes.
I'm getting pretty good at just flicking my thumb.
Just like these little tiny victories that you get every, you know, several blocks.
Pretty darn good right there.
Just really are fun and just make your day really wonderful.
Nice.
Another thing really wonderful, the company Nintendo that owns Pokemon and rolled out this free app, take a look at its stock price. While other investors chase little market blips and dips, Nintendo can say it's scored the first big win in the augmented reality space, a technology designed for fighter jet pilots and surgeons. Pokemon Go has raised Nintendo's stock price more than 30% this week. Can you dig it?
Pretty darn good right there.
Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go.
So let's get the lowdown on Pokemon Go from a super user journalist. There have been privacy concerns for something so successful so quickly, and already some companies have reportedly developed patches to keep private data from being seen by platforms that host Pokemon Go. It will be a while before all the bugs are worked out there. But in the meantime, lots of fun will be had, says Polygon reporter Allegra Frank.
I could talk about Pokemon forever. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
So this is like something from your youth, which appears to still be going on, and fused with this augmented reality thing.
Definitely. It's definitely a nostalgic experience, this Pokemon Go game that everyone is talking about. But at the same time, it's definitely a reinvention of this franchise. It's not just bringing back the classic Pokemon game for the modern audience. It's really revolutionizing it for this contemporary audience using the smartphone technology.
Is this the magic convergence of mobile technology, augmented reality, and basically the gaming vocabulary of something that millennials grew up with?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like it, right? I mean, it seems like this is sort of this major crossover hit in a way that many people didn't anticipate. I'm sure this is what the developers wanted. But even for me, as someone who was a beta tester who has been following along with this closely, is a diehard Pokemon fan, the breadth, the scope of the popularity of this is kind of shocking. And it really seems that they've latched onto something here with the combination of all like the price point being free, the fact that anyone can play it because it's on smartphones, and the fact that there is this huge install base already of Pokemon fans.
What does that mean for what Nintendo can do with this base of customers, people that are Nintendoing? I mean, the stock went up 30%, but if it's all free, it'll go down 30%.
Right. So the game does have microtransactions. It has items you can purchase for real money, not just, you know, fake in-game currency. So you can spend upwards of $100 on a certain amount of these coins that then you can trade in the game itself. But hopefully, I'm assuming hopefully the goal here is to translate these newfound fans, this new player base, to the core Pokemon series. So there is a new Pokemon game, a pair of games coming out for the Nintendo 3DS console later this year, and that's going to cost $40. There's two of them coming out at once, so hopefully people will buy both. So that's $80 right there. And so building this new player base of people, this larger group of people who are interested in Pokemon, I assume the hope is that they'll translate to these pricier, longer games.
How do you know somebody's playing?
The other day I was walking actually around Bryant Park towards my office, and I saw someone stop in the street, and I had Pokemon Go out. So I was looking at my phone, looking up, looking at my phone, and I see that there's a Pokemon right in front of me. And I'm like, all right, you know what? I know I'm in the middle of Midtown, but I need to stop. I need this Pokemon. So I stop, but I kind of look around me to make sure, okay, am I in anyone's way? And I see that someone else has stopped. And I see that we're both pointing our phones in the same direction. And I kind of peek over to his screen, and we are trying to catch the same Pokemon. I'm like, I don't think so. I think I'm going to get this one first. But that's definitely something I've been noticing, just people stopping in the middle of the street, holding their phones out, swiping repeatedly on their screens, trying to catch these Pokemon. It's really funny to me. And of course, like, we see people staring at their phones in the middle of the sidewalk all the time. But the fact that you have to actually stay perfectly still and be swiping repeatedly on your phone, that's definitely a giveaway.
So this guy you met in Midtown, you guys are going off to Europe together for the fall, and you're engaged?
We're best friends. We're best friends. Although, I got the Zubat, so he has that chip on his shoulder, but...
Typical. Allegra Frank, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Allegra Frank is a reporter for the gaming website Polygon, and a shout-out and a thank you to Takeaway investigative reporter Isabel Angel. I use investigative guardedly. She used her lunch hour to probe the augmented reality of Pokemon Go. She was the one blocking the sidewalk. Actor Bryan Cranston much prefers reality to the dark madness of Breaking Bad these days. Reality sure beats the massive celebrity Cranston has also had to deal with, which is why his new movie about a real undercover cop and one of the biggest sting operations in history is a great one.
You're here because of me. And I feel responsible for your safety.
I appreciate that. You don't have to worry about me. I'm a big girl.
It's not about that. It's one wrong word, one slip, and we have to be very careful.
It's a labor of love, this movie, The Infiltrator. Bryan Cranston plays Robert Mazur, a federal agent who goes undercover as Bob Muzella to disrupt Pablo Escobar's drug cartel. Got eventually 85 drug lords indicted. The feds were able to take down the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI. A plot as outlandish as the movie Sicario, but this story is real. Cranston says he loved seeing how this real person, Bob Mazur, coped with a very unreal situation.
Bob Mazur was a very meticulous man. Make sure, double checks, triple checks everything, very careful. But even as careful as he could be, every time he drove home from the day of being a money launderer to going home and becoming a father and a husband, he took a circuitous route and never took the same path away, always making sure that there's no possibility he was being followed. And to this day, he doesn't accept any photography or video or anything like that. They augment his voice. He's with us in New York. He will be in the audience at our premiere. And
you think? No one knows what he looks like.
I know what he looks like. Yeah. But he'll be hiding in plain sight because there is concern about reprisals for what he did to take down a big chunk of the Medellin cartel.
I mentioned Sicario before, Emily Blunt movie, which is a very stylized, almost a music video of this kind of world. You play it more straight.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's a better story that way?
Well, I don't know. I like Sicario. So
I like Sicario too.
Yeah, yeah, I really did. And Emily's terrific. But this, you know, I think you should set the tone that is appropriate to the story that you're telling. And in this story, Infiltrator, it is very serious. And at any moment, things could have gone south, and 2.5 years of undercover work could have been wiped out. And on top of that, he could have been killed. With me, as an actor who often slips into the shoes of someone else, If I make a mistake, we just do it over again. But if he makes a mistake, it could be the end of his life.
How conscious were you of having the responsibility for those people's lives, and how hard was it to shift over into being, you know, daddy, you know, when in the sort of world that has nothing to do with money laundering?
That's what really attracted me to the Infiltrator as a story. Not only the plot is fantastic. 2.5 years of undercover work, laundering money for the cartel, and that many arrests, 85 arrests at the time. But what really attracted me was, how does that man who is dirty during the day and goes home and has to clean up and be dad and husband and take out the trash and help with the homework and doing things that all dads and husbands do, how do you just switch gears like that? It was a fascinating tale. And he did it. I mean, there was definitely some friction that they had to work through. But to this day, he and Ev are still married, happily married, and they have, their kids are grown and have children of their own. And it's a new chapter in his life. But this was a very, very tenuous time.
Did he give you insights into how he did that switching?
Not so much of how he did the switching, but how he covered himself. How he made sure he covered his tracks. He opened his home. We had dinner with all of them. I talked to his kids separately to find out their perspective, what was Bob Mazur like as a father at that time, and also other people in the department who were around at the time. And then his book, The Infiltrator book, was very helpful. It was like our Bible.
Any props from the 80s that you particularly coveted in this project?
I didn't want any of those clothes, ostrich boots and and big puffy shoulder pads and the suits. Everything is slick and silky and kind of unctuous. And I really didn't.
Leguizamo has that stuff in his closet.
Yeah, he just brought his own wardrobe.
Right, right.
The sunglasses were kind of fun, but that was my own that was my own mustache and my own hair. I just let it grow and then just poofed it up into a big kind of pompadour and shoved it back, and it kind of made it okay.
Those were the years of Miami Vice, of course.
Yeah.
And you know, the glamour of a job which, you know, actors always get reminded when they meet the real deal that there's no glamour here and there's no income here. And there's what's it like for a guy like Mazur, who's, you know, he's just doing a job. He's not, you know, a hero, and he's certainly not going to, you know, retire on a big boat in Miami.
No, unless he's crooked, which Bob isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's plenty of opportunities, I think, for undercover cops to go sideways, especially if there is any money problems that you might have at home. To put that under your nose it would be tough. For Bob, it wasn't tough. His nobility far exceeded any kind of personal desire for financial gain or anything like that. He was a very by-the-book cop, and he did things the right way, and he was very dignified. He now operates security companies, and so he was able to segue into other opportunities for him. And he's doing quite well.
Speaking of people doing quite well, are you headed to some Netflix or HBO kind of, you know, 3-year immersion into some binge-watching world? See you forever in some character?
No, I'm currently producing a show called Sneaky Pete here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for Amazon. Very proud of it. And it's going to be available later on this year.
And, you know, so many people describe this time as, you know, a golden age of television and of, you know, scripted dramas. And, you know, we've always heard that writers are just the most abused and miserable people. Are they happier now, Brian? Are the writers happy?
I don't know if writers will ever be really happy. I mean, they are a very interesting, by and large, I said, insecure group. There's a sense of insecurity that is pervasive, I think, intrinsically in a writer. That being said, there is no more important element to the storytelling process than the writer. There's no question of it in my mind whatsoever. It is the genesis of a story, and the development of that story needs to be respected and nurtured. Actors know this. We know that we're only as good as the material that we have before us. And that's what's funny. As I talk about Breaking Bad, and, you know, I was the face of Breaking Bad, but the person who deserves the lion's share of that success is Vince Gilligan and his writing staff, who wrote this brilliant story. And we get handed these wonderful presents every week, each episode. And all we need to do is not mess it up. Just learn it, put it up on its feet, and we receive tremendous praise for it. But the truth is, it really belongs to the writers.
That's Bryan Cranston, who stars in The Infiltrator in theaters today. A reminder that while you're playing Pokemon Go, you can listen to the Takeaway podcast. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Catch up on the day's news. Give us a rating. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.